Last month, California was awash in rain, and the Gulf states, too, have seen heavy weather lately. This is not just a run of bad luck. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, much of this winter's nasty weather can be explained in two words: El Niño.
Scientists knew last summer that this was going to be an El Niño year. And last December, Californians learned, the hard way, that it was no ordinary El Niño.
It was a wet and wild commute for drivers across California as road crews tried to keep ahead of a massive winter storm.
That report from the Associated Press was one of a litany on California television as back-to-back rainstorms inundated the state. The Mid-Atlantic got much the same treatment, though it came down as snow. The strong El Niño and the subsequent precipitation is a result of something that started thousands of miles out in the Pacific Ocean.
Ocean temperatures across the equatorial and tropical Pacific Ocean are somewhere upwards of 2 degrees Celsius above average. So we've had what we would characterize as a strong El Niño.
That's Mike Halpert, Deputy Director of the Climate Prediction Center at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Scientists at the center say this is the strongest El Niño since the 1997-98 winter. What happens is that unusually warm surface temperatures in the western Pacific move east. That changes the heating pattern of the atmosphere, which in turn pulls the Pacific jet stream farther south. A jet stream is a fast and narrow current of air that travels high up in the atmosphere.
And that jet stream is where we see a lot of storminess typically, and then we saw a very classical case of that. A super strong jet extended all the way across the Pacific with storms impacting California one after the other.
A strong El Niño also alters another jet stream nearer to the equator and brings more storms to the Gulf area. In fact, a strong El Niño plays havoc with weather from Indonesia to the Atlantic, but in different ways. Indonesia gets unusually dry weather, and in fact, fires in parts of Indonesia have been frequent recently. Peru, on the west coast of South America, tends to get what California gets, flooding rains. Halpert says storms are local events, and no single storm can be attributed directly to the phenomenon.
One way to think of it is that El Niño conditions the atmosphere for these types of storms.
Halpert also points out that scientists don't know yet whether climate change is influencing the frequency or strength of El Niños. Scientists say El Niño will likely persist another month or two. That usually means drier than usual weather in the Pacific Northwest and Ohio Valley, wetter in the West and Southwest, and colder in the Southeast. El Niño has done some good in the southwestern U.S., for example.
Nobody can remember seeing such a small amount of drought on the map. So this El Niño has taken a pretty big bite out of some pretty severe drought conditions that had developed last summer.
And by altering jet streams, El Niño apparently also helped moderate last year's hurricane season in the Atlantic. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
We wondered what goes into a snow forecast, and we've called Doug Hill to find out. He's chief meteorologist at ABC 7 News, Washington's ABC affiliate. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
And Doug, how do you make these calculations of projected snowfall? What goes into them?
It's a long process, but at the very beginning, at the very foundation of what we do, we take a look at computer models. You've heard meteorologists talk about that, I'm sure, on radio and TV many times. These are mathematical equations derived from observations, and actual raw weather data is put into the model to the beginning of each computer model run. And the programs are able to quite accurately predict what is going to happen at different levels and layers in the atmosphere over 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days or longer.
So when you as a meteorologist are taking that information that the computer spits out and you're applying your human intelligence to that, what else are you bringing to bear?
Well, actually, I like to explain it sometimes as weather forecasting is an art form that is based on science. In the real chaotic world we live in, our atmosphere, the way it is, and the way patterns change, you have to have that ability that is beyond pure science. You have to understand the area in which you're forecasting. Understand how storms normally affect your area and compare one to the other to give you that intuitive advantage that you add on top of the scientific knowledge and data, and that's how you go about making a forecast.
You know, I'm thinking back to this snowstorm this past weekend, the really big one, and meteorologists were predicting 3 inches of snowfall each hour at the height. How do you figure that out?
Well, by the rate of fall, you can tell by intensity on Doppler radar. Once again, thanks to the wonders of computers, we have algorithms that can detect for us the rate of fall of the precipitation based on its intensity. How fast and how strong does the radar return come back to the radar transmitter? So we can do a quick calculation and convert that to inches.
And how much of this is affected by the amount of moisture in the snow in terms of how much snowfall ultimately piles up?
That is really important, and that's called a snow ratio. If just an example, you take an inch of liquid. Can't call it rain because we're not turning rain to snow, but just say equivalent of an inch of liquid, of water. At normal ratios, that would produce 10 to 12 inches of snow. But as the air is colder and the dendritic formation, the actual snowflakes, as they begin to form, if it forms in a much colder, drier environment aloft, what can happen is that ratio can climb to 20 to 1, 30 to 1, maybe sometimes 40 to 1 under ideal circumstances. So given the same amount of liquid, what we have to do is forecast what that ratio will be. If we have the ratio all wrong, then we're going to be completely wrong on the forecasted snow amount.
The wetter snow would be denser and more compact?
Right, more water in it, and the drier snow would be fluffier and would pile up more. Here's a good example, the big weekend storm. That was 30 inches of wet snow with high water content in the snowflakes. When that accumulated, it started compacting. And because of the amount of water per snowflake, the weight of that 30 inches of snow was much heavier than 30 inches of light, fluffy, dry snow.
Yeah, and having been out there shoveling it, I know
right.
I can tell how heavy that was. Do you think, Doug, that this has all gotten more accurate over time? I mean, the snowstorm this past weekend, it just seemed like it started exactly when people said it would start. It ended just about exactly when people said it would end, and the accumulation was just about spot on.
All of us who make our living forecasting weather are very happy with a couple of the computer models these days. And I think any meteorologist that's being honest with you will tell you that it's the excellent performance of two particular computer models. There are quite a few we look at, but two in particular that have been excellent for the past couple months.
So fist bumps around the weather room.
Absolutely.
After that storm?
Or keyboard bumps. Yeah, same idea.
And what about this one?
Well, this time around, the computer models are not as much in agreement as they were on Saturday, but pretty darn close to it.
Doug Hill, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Doug Hill is Chief Meteorologist and Vice President of Weather at ABC 7 News here in Washington, D.C. Well, one day will you be President of Weather, Doug?
I'm happy with what I have right now. I don't want the extra headaches.
Okay.
Art curators may have a new way to address an old problem, identifying forgeries. A mathematician at Dartmouth College has come up with a technique that could help determine whether you're buying an excellent copy or the real thing. NPR's Jill Palka has more.
Sometimes you choose a career. Sometimes it chooses you. Take Daniel Rockmore. He's currently chairman of the mathematics department at Dartmouth College.
I joke a lot that I'm a mathematician by mistake. It was something that I had an aptitude at, but I've always had lots of other interests.
One thing Rockmore is particularly interested in is art, and he's found a way to integrate his interest in art with his career in mathematics. Specifically, he's come up with ways of analyzing digital images.
A digital image is a collection of pixels, so the list of those pixels actually describes an image, for example, the digital representation of a painting, as a coordinate in a very high, thousands of dimensional space.
And who better than a mathematician to make sense of something that has thousands of dimensions? One day, back in 2001, Rockmore was talking to a friend of his who was an art historian in New York City.
And a friend of hers, Nadine Orenstein, is in the drawings department at the Metropolitan Museum.
And I was working on a Bruegel exhibition at the time.
Orenstein is talking about Peter Bruegel, the Elder, a Flemish painter of the 16th century.
The exhibition was of Peter Bruegel's drawings and prints.
Orenstein says she invited Rockmore to come to the museum to see the exhibition. It featured works by Bruegel, but Ornstein says there were also several drawings on display that were once thought to be Bruegel's, but weren't.
Our exhibition was really the first time that we were getting together in one place, all of the drawings by Bruegel and the ones that were no longer considered to be by him.
And so Nadine was explaining to me the various particular pen strokes that seem to be characteristic of the way Bruegel works, the way he creates a scene.
And Rockmore realized that if he had digital images of these drawings, he could use his math skills to design a computer program that would analyze those pen strokes and characterize which were Bruegel-like and which weren't. So he and some colleagues got hold of the digital images, and they wrote the program.
And we did a pretty good job.
That was in 2004. Now, as he reports in a recent edition of the journal PNAS, he's done a better job using a different kind of statistical sampling technique. For the moment, Rockmore has only tested his program on Bruegel drawings, but there's no reason it couldn't be used for other artists. But Rockmore says even if the program did indicate that a particular work seemed fishy, that wouldn't prove it was a fake. He says his program only says whether a particular drawing is consistent with an artist's style, not whether it's a fraud. The Metropolitan Museum's Nadine Ornstein agrees.
That might put a little light bulb in the head of, you know, the scholar and say, oh, you know, here's something we have to further investigate.
For his part, Rockmore isn't particularly interested in designing a mathematical tool for tracking down art forgeries. He hopes his work will offer art historians a new way of deconstructing art, a way of describing what it means to be Picasso-like or Bruegel-like.
You get at deeper questions about the creation of art and our experience of art, but, you know, it's probably more fun to report on whether or not that's a fake Bruegel.
Although, reporting on the science of how we experience art is fun, too. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Astronauts often say that one of the best things about being in space is looking down at the beautiful blue Earth. Well, now the International Space Station is about to get what NASA is calling a room with a view. It's a kind of observation tower that will give astronauts a window on the world unlike any other in space. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports.
Right now, astronauts on board the station can peer out through small portholes. The biggest, best window is in the U.S. Destiny Lab. It's a porthole 20 inches across. But this Sunday morning, Space Shuttle Endeavour is scheduled to blast off on a mission to deliver a new room to the station. This room will have a 360-degree bay window called the cupola. It has seven windows, so astronauts can float inside and be surrounded by panoramic views. Terry Virts will be a first-time space flyer on the Endeavour mission.
The one thing that I'm really looking forward to, and I know all my crewmates are also, is getting a chance to look out of the cupola with the seven windows and the view that we're going to get there. That's going to be really special to see that view of the Earth and of space, and that's going to be fun.
Technically, the new windows aren't for fun. They'll help astronauts orchestrate outside work, things like spacewalks, robotic arm operations, and docking spaceships. And the windows do have aluminum shutters that will often be closed. That's to keep them from being hit by tiny bits of flying space rock or space junk, even though the tough windows already are several panes thick. Still, the astronauts can't wait to get the new room all installed and finally open those shutters for the first time. Kay Heyer is an astronaut going up on Endeavour.
We will definitely be bringing along some still cameras as well as video cameras to try to capture those views as best we can to share with you.
But she says she can guarantee those photos won't be able to convey exactly what it's like to see the vast expanse of Earth and space spread out all around. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along?
For most of us, the prospect of losing money is scary.
Scientists say that's because somewhere in our brains is a little voice urging caution when money is at stake. Now researchers think they've found out where that voice lives. NPR's John Hamilton has the story.
There's an unusual woman in California who takes part in research studies from time to time. Scientists refer to her by her initials, SM.
She's quite normal, kind of a cheerful person. She sort of likes being involved in the studies.
Colin Kammerer studies behavioral economics at Caltech. He says if you look closely, there are hints that SM isn't quite like other people.
Most people, if you stand about 3 feet away from them, they feel very comfortable. If you come 1.5 feet away, they kind of freak out. But SM doesn't mind if you come walk right up to her.
That's because a part of SM's brain called the amygdala has been damaged by a rare disease. Kammerer says in most people, one of the jobs of the amygdala is to tell us not to let someone stand too close.
Sort of an early warning system about impending threat.
Kammerer and his colleagues wanted to know if the amygdala provided warnings about financial threats as well as physical ones. So they had SM, a second woman with damage to her amygdala, and several people with normal brains play a gambling game. Kammerer says the people with normal brains were reluctant to risk money even when the odds were in their favor. But it was a different story for both women with amygdala damage. And Kammerer says SM was just plain reckless.
She really didn't mind losing dollars compared to winning dollars, almost like loss-seeking or, let's say, very loss-tolerant.
Kammerer says the results offer strong evidence that the amygdala really is the source of that little voice that urges financial caution.
The amygdala is broadcasting kind of a fear or vigilance signal, like be careful, don't take this gamble, or take this gamble only if the amount we can win is really great.
Unless you're a compulsive gambler, of course. Kammerer suspects that if you could compare the brains of these extreme financial risk takers with the brains of people who never gamble, you would find a difference in the amygdala. The research appears in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Researchers in San Diego say blue whales are singing a new song. They don't know why it's happening, but scientists report that blue whales are now singing a half octave lower than they did in the 1960s. From member station KPBS, Tom Fudge reports.
Here on the coast of San Diego, it's not unheard of to see a spouting blue whale. The eastern Pacific is one of a handful of areas where blue whales migrate and feed. Just a couple blocks from here is the office of John Hildebrand. He's a professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and he studies the sounds of dolphins and whales.
So that's the pulse part of the blue whale. My iTunes, but
that pulsing sound was one of the songs a male blue whale sings to warn away other males and to attract females. But Hildebrand says their song has been changing.
They've been shifting the frequency, they've been shifting the pitch of the song to be lower each year, and that shift in pitch has resulted in a song that's now about 30% lower than it was in the 1960s.
Hildebrand says this change in register is happening in blue whale colonies all over the world, and he believes the change is tied to the elimination of blue whale hunting. Before hunting was banned in 1966, the numbers of blue whales were dangerously low.
Worldwide, in the early 60s, there probably would have been a few thousand.
Those low numbers meant there were few females available to hear a male's come-hither song. Hildebrand says for males in that situation,
there's a push to have the sound go to higher frequency so that more of the girls can hear it.
In other words, the guys had to shout to be heard. But now that blue whales are more numerous, Hildebrand thinks the males have gone back to singing bass because it makes them sound bigger and more attractive to females. He says males of many species use lower tones to attract mates.
In fact, human females, if you put some headphones on and play a bunch of male voices, and you say, I want you to pick out the sexy voice. Do they pick the weak little voice, or do they pick the big booming voice? Right? I mean, you know the answer.
No one disputes the finding that blue whale song has gone down in pitch, but Hildebrand's theory of why it's happening has raised some eyebrows.
It's a great anthropomorphism.
Richard Ellis is a whale expert at New York's Natural History Museum.
I really don't think the whales, for all their big brains and everything else, I really don't think the whales think about this.
Still, if a lower tone becomes an advantage to some males, Hildebrand says it will be copied by others. His article is published in the journal Endangered Species Research. For NPR News, I'm Tom Fudge in San Diego.
The girls, they are like swimming. scrumptious snowbirds sing. We're flying above a visitor list. Place is just too cold for me. And one by one, and all together. And one by one.
Ladies, you know how men seem to be in love with their gadgets? Does all their gear make them more or less attractive? Science suggests that the answer is more. And guys, before you run out and upgrade your smartphones, take note of this. The technology in this next story refers to stone axes and other basic tools of agriculture. And the smitten women are the hunter-gatherers of prehistoric Europe. NPR's Richard Harris explains.
In these days of electronic gizmos and biotech, we don't necessarily think of farming and animal herding as cutting-edge technologies. But when people in the Near East developed them about 10,000 years ago, it changed everything.
You can regard it as the most important cultural change in the history of modern humans.
Mark Jobling is at the University of Leicester in England.
It allowed people to generate their own food and populations to grow and to societies to become specialized and so on.
It was the foundation of modern civilization. So there's more than a little interest in understanding just how agriculture spread from where it originated, which was in present-day Turkey and Iraq. Over about 4,000 years, these transforming technologies moved west throughout all of Europe. The question is whether just the ideas swept the continent or whether the farmers themselves did.
We certainly know that the technology moved, so the evidence for whether the people moved or not has come a lot from genetic research in modern populations.
And that brings us to the story of the guys with their agricultural know-how. To track their movements, Jobling and his colleagues have been tracing the genetics of the Y chromosome, which is passed only from father to son. And in his new study in the journal PLOS Biology, he concludes that farming men did indeed move from the Fertile Crescent in the Near East all across Europe. But here's the strange part. He did not see that pattern of westward movement of women when he looked at genes handed down exclusively from mothers.
And some people think, well, one of them must be wrong. They've got to be the same. But our view really is, well, why should they be? Because they reflect the different sexes. And we know that men and women have behaved differently today and in the past.
In this case, Jobling sees a couple of possible explanations. He says maybe only farming men went west to seek their fortunes and left the farming women behind. As they moved west, the men made families with the hunter-gatherer women. Another possibility?
More likely that as the populations expanded from the Near East, they contained men and women. But then the indigenous people, the hunter-gatherers, were already in Europe. The women were incorporated into these societies and had offspring.
Men can have more kids than women, presuming they aren't monogamous, so their genes would spread much faster than the genes of any women who were traveling with them. And it seems the women in Europe welcomed the farmers with open arms. In fact, the finding implies that the hunter-gatherer men of Europe were the real losers here. They couldn't compete with the Johnny-come-latelys who knew how to grow grain and tend animals, so their genes faded from the population. The result is the genetic pattern we see in many Europeans today. Male genes from farmers who hailed from the Near East, and female genes mostly from women who had been hunter-gatherers in Europe after the last ice age. So, to the punchline, does technology make men more sexy?
That would be one way to interpret it.
That's Peter Underhill at Stanford University, and he says sex appeal isn't the only possible reason.
It might be in terms of not just physical appearance, but in terms of ability to provide for offspring.
So the farmers' daughters and sons would have more to eat, and therefore would be more likely to survive and spread their genes to future generations. Underhill says the British study makes a pretty strong case for that. Michael Hammer from the University of Arizona has found the same sort of story in how agriculture spread both in Africa and Japan.
Again, the Y chromosome shows this very, very clear pattern that looks like it's reflecting the spread of agriculture into Japan starting about 2100, 2300 years ago.
And once again, it appears that men moved in on a population of women and outcompeted the men who were there already. So, assuming these scientists are reading the genes right, technology really can make a guy more attractive. Richard Harris, NPR News.
She thinks my tractor's sexy. It really turns her on. She's always staying.